This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, May 25th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you know, even little kids learn very early on about the old good cop, bad cop routine.
Wake up! Where did you find the piece of resistance?
The piece of what?
The piece of resistance.
Liam Neeson in the Lego Movie playing a Lego cop who is both a good cop and a bad cop. And then there's the famous legendary detective who broke all the rules. He was neither.
Just one more thing.
Columbo, played by the late Peter Falk, cajoling the truth out of powerless, frustrated criminals.
So that was the motive. Their affair. That's why you killed your wife, Dr. Mason.
We begin this hour exploring how local law enforcement is looking to toss out the folklore of evidence gathering and use some real testing and hard science to make police interrogations less of an action movie audition a la Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration? I didn't mean to do that. Please, continue. You were saying something about best intentions?
That's right. The future may be less pulp fiction and more reasonable reality. New research funded by the FBI and CIA, among others, is behind a President Obama 2010 initiative to reshape interrogation by the military and local law enforcement. Robert Kolker is an author and journalist, and he has reported on how the police department in Los Angeles is reinventing its approach to interrogation for the Marshall Project and Wired magazine.
It's funny, in the popular imagination, the interrogation is what we see on TV or in the movies with the bare bulb hanging from the ceiling and the, you know, small confining room and the psychological game played between the interrogator and the subject where the, you know, the suspect is put in a box, both metaphorically and physically. And the weird thing is that in real life, it often follows that model also. The police don't get a lot of formal interrogation training. Instead, they get a lot of received folk wisdom that is in the same mode, and they treat suspects like they are prey to be stalked.
And so Hollywood depictions of police interrogations, whether they're contemporary cops or going back to, you know, the Untouchables, are essentially training films?
Well, they're a reflection of the reality, and there are lots of different ways to go with it. I mean, you see different aspects of it in places like The Wire. There's the motivation to close cases and to clear cases and to get them out the door and to get a confession. You know, that's a big part of modern day police work too, sometimes to the detriment of the suspects who are actually innocent.
And getting a confession moves the case forward, which is one of the motivations for all the plea deals that are made, because cops make the argument, you might as well plead guilty. It's going to be much easier for you than if you try to go to trial here, even if they're innocent.
Exactly. That's the potential dark side to the innocent until proven guilty system that we have. Yes, you're innocent until proven guilty, but we have a system that needs to move quickly. And the process of interrogation is, as some critics say, guilt presumptive. And so you're pressured to get out the door one way or another.
Rewarded for falsely saying you're guilty.
Yeah. I mean, the worst example of this is the Central Park Five case, at least in our popular memory, where five people were pressured overnight, convinced through deceit and trickery that life would just be better for them if they said they did it. And they did.
All right. So with that as the status quo on some level, how have law enforcement agencies and scientists gone about to try to establish some rules here?
For decades, there have been these repeated criticisms of the system, and the defense from the establishment in law enforcement has been, first of all, nobody would ever say they did it if they didn't do it. And secondly, well, what have you got to prove to us, you know, that there's a better way? And interestingly, for the last six or so years, there's been a wealth of research suggesting a better way to do it, and it's been funded by the federal government. And the most interesting thing of all is that it's an outgrowth of the war on terror. It's called the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group, or the HIG. The HIG was started by the Obama administration in 2010. It's an interagency group with the FBI and CIA and others, and much of what they do is classified, but much of what they do is quite public. They fund dozens of academic research on the way to come up with non-coercive interrogation techniques that yield accurate information and decrease the likelihood of a false confession.
And better is more truthful, less coercive, less cruel, less brutal. What's the measure?
Well, the goalpost has changed. If the point of an interrogation in the olden days was to get a confession, now the point of an interrogation is to get as much accurate information or any information from the person as possible, get them talking as much as possible so that you can check it against verifiable facts, against other testimony, against the record, and, you know, develop an accurate view of the case. Now, that's labor intensive, takes time. It also takes careful planning, and it goes against the image a lot of police have of themselves as being the guy who's winging it in the interrogation room trying to figure the other person out and get them to confess. Instead, it's more of a collaborative effort. It's a team of investigators planning an interview, deciding which way to go with it, trying to find different ways to make sure that the suspect, above all, keeps on talking, even if it's untruthful, so that they can catch them in inconsistencies or develop a more accurate view of the case.
What communities are using these techniques?
The HIG started in the military, and in recent years, they've tried to fan out into domestic law enforcement with different pilot projects. And the biggest participant so far has been the LAPD, interestingly. You know, the police department of Rodney King fame is interested in this. They sent two investigators a few years ago who I profile in the Wired Marshall Project story. They sent them to be trained, and as soon as they came back, they got put on a case that was about to become cold. They interviewed a guy who had clammed up around other investigators because he wasn't interested in being a prey stalked by a hunter. And with this new interrogation technique, he opened up like never before, spoke for 5 hours, gave them tons of information that they could check against the record. And while he never technically confessed, it gave them enough to arrest him. And he's now serving, you know, a 25-year sentence for murder.
What was the secret? They brought a six-pack of beer into the room?
As I hear myself talk, it sounds like what I'm saying is you have to coddle the suspect. You buy them a cup of tea and suddenly they'll spill the beans. But it's a little different from that. Essentially, it's a way of engaging with the suspect in a non-confrontational way that, you know, sure, it's respectful and sure, it seems warm and fuzzy. But more than anything else, you aren't the one doing the talking. The big thing about the current way of interrogating, the one that's potentially flawed, is that it uses something called theming, where from the very start, the interrogator walks in and says, listen, I know how you did this. You know, it seems pretty clear to me. You know, you got off of work at 5 p.m., you killed him at 5:30, and then you were at the bar at 6 o'clock, and I have six people who tell me that that's what they saw you here and they saw you there. You know, it's a theme, and suddenly that puts the person in a box, and they have to fight their way out of the box one way or the other. The Higgs method is more open-ended. It's tell me about your day. Talk about it. Talk about it some more. Talk about it some more. Now try and tell me it backwards. You know, try and find some ways to, you know, tell me the story that make it clear to me that you have a level of detail of information that isn't difficult for you to recall. And if you are having difficulty, let's talk about that. Whatever you're doing, you're not talking. Mm. The suspect is talking.
How is this different from good cop, bad cop that actually and is so permeated into our understanding? It's in the Lego movie.
It is different from good cop, bad cop. It is it's a whole other model that's, you know, that in the best of circumstances might even put an oppositional suspect off balance and make them think that they actually have the upper hand by talking. It's a little like Columbo, to tell you the truth.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it's a little bit like this World War II, this famous legendary Nazi interrogator named Hans Scharf, who supposedly was so smooth he made friends with all of the American pilots who he interrogated who were prisoners of war, and they ended up loving him even though they gave up information. You know, it's a different type of smooth-talking, silver-tongued interrogator.
Is it possible because of the folklore that you describe that interrogations are, you know, very much a familiar script from movies and folklore, that defendants are prepared for this and that derails the current situation, that they know what's coming. They know about good cop, bad cop. They know about the box and the, oh, you did this. We know you did this kind of thing.
It's true. I mean, the detectives who I interviewed for the Wired and Marshall Project story, they talk about how in the past, they've gone into the room and they've said, I know you did it, and then nothing you say will change my mind. And the other person says, well, then I'm not saying anything then. And they're at an impasse. And they think to themselves, well, there's got to be a better way than this. It's possible that there's a subset of people out there who just, you know what's coming and they know to shut up. And that's that.
Robert Kolker, fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Robert Kolker is an author and journalist. He wrote a story on this subject for The Marshall Project and Wired. Coming up in a moment, a pair of U.S. mayors talk about the power of DIYism, local power taking on tough issues that federal politicians won't touch, apparently, with a 10-foot pole. But first, we have one of those mayors for a few minutes to talk about the unrest we saw and heard last night in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mayor Richard Berry, mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico. What happened at that Donald Trump rally in your capital city last night?
Well, we had a rally, and like we see across the country with a number of the political candidates, candidate came in, did their thing. Rally was over. We had some protesters there protesting the candidate, had supporters there supporting the candidate. And then after the rally, there were some folks that stuck around, and maybe they weren't there for political reasons, but started causing some mayhem. So our police officers, kept the peace and showed a lot of restraint and really worked with other members of the community to make sure that everybody got home safely. But there were some folks throwing rocks and creating some havoc.
As a Republican, how worried are you that this will become the signature image of Donald Trump's candidacy as we move into the general election and get closer to the convention?
Well, interestingly, Bernie was in town a couple days before. Big crowd there as well. What we saw is what we saw a little bit with the Trump rally. There's a lot of folks out there, whether they're Bernie supporters or Clinton supporters, some I guess too, or Trump supporters. There's just a lot of folks out there that aren't really happy with the way things are going. So as America's mayors, we're out there doing a couple of things. We're trying to make sure that we're setting policy on Main Street that really impacts people's lives and matters, because we don't see a lot of that coming out of Washington. We see a lot of political candidates making sure that everybody concentrates on their differences. And as mayors, we're just trying to bring folks together in our communities and lift each other up and make sure that people have opportunities. So I think this whole campaign has been built around ideas on both sides of the aisle that there's inequity out there. I think we recognize that as America's mayors, whether you're Republican or Democrat mayors, and we're just trying to impact it.
Frustrating, though?
With what?
The divisions within the GOP?
Well, it's interesting to watch democracy work. I mean,
you got that one right.
No, I mean, really, I think we have a beautiful system in this country, and sometimes that system's frustrating, whether it's based on inaction or perceived inaction coming out of Washington, and sometimes it comes right down to Main Street. So,
well, we're going to talk about some very interesting things happening on two main streets around the United States. Mayor Richard Berry, mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico, where there was some unrest at a Trump rally last night. We'll continue with him, one of two mayors here in the East, taking a look at racial matters on the streets of communities in the United States. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. And Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
And now we've got a pair of mayors, boy, is that fun to say, taking some important matters for their communities into their own hands. Five major U.S. cities, in fact, Austin, Texas, Albuquerque, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Louisville, Kentucky, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, are meeting here in New York with the goal of creating communities that better serve everyone. The initiative is called Racial Equity Here. It's a collaboration between the nonprofit organization Living Cities and the Government Alliance for Race and Equity. Albuquerque Mayor Richard Berry, you heard a moment ago. Austin, Texas Mayor Steve Adler is here in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
How are you?
Great, great, great. So I love city politics. I love the power of mayors to really make things happen and the collaborative energy that often it happens in City Hall. And I'm just wondering if it's easier for you to take action on issues like racial equity. The president likes to talk about being a big convener, but sometimes he can convene from very, very far away, and the impact is hard to see on the ground.
I think it's probably both easier and also more important at the city level. As a mayor, your local government's actually expected to get things done and actually change conditions on the ground at the at the federal level, at the state level, it's a little bit more polarized, not quite as close to the people. I go out to the grocery store. My constituents are with me all the time. It's close. There's an expectation for performance that exists at the municipal level that I don't immediate result that doesn't exist at the state or federal level.
Does having the power to deal with pragmatic issues like sewer and trash collection and all the things that go into the running of a city make racial equity an easier issue to come up in those contexts sometimes? A lot of times in Washington, you're just dealing with it purely abstractly. On the ground in a city, sometimes there's a racial component to trash collection, and when you deal with that, suddenly a lot of other issues get resolved.
Well,
and
as a mayor, you don't have the luxury of stepping in and out of conversations like you can if you're separated from the city geographically or you know, like we see in Washington. And so it puts us in a unique position where, you know, I live in a city with – I've got 600,000 brothers and sisters that I serve every day as mayor. Mm. And I think most mayors that I deal with feel the same way. You're very close to your boss, and that's a good thing. And it allows you to paint with a little broader brush sometimes. It allows you to bring people together and impact it through a collective impact model action. And so we always joke as mayors, your first job this morning is, you know, make sure the garbage gets picked up, and then you can do big things. Well, picking up the garbage can be a big thing if it doesn't get mm-hmm. done. And so it puts us in a place where I think our constituents look at us and say, well, it's a very pragmatic place to be. It's a very pragmatic place to govern from. And if you're a mayor that truly shows an interest outside of just the day-to-day operations of government, you can actually do wonderful things, but you can't do it without your community. Mm-hmm. And I think mayors also have, the mayors that I work with around the country, have a good ability to pull people together, and you can have a convening and then have some real actionable items come from those meetings.
Albuquerque, great city. Mayor Barry is a Republican. Austin, Texas, great city. Mayor Adler is a Democrat. You guys don't have anything to say to each other, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're a whole lot less interested in
it's like Boehner and Pelosi here, right?
Yeah. You know, the kind of things we talk about, though, are we're sharing ideas on how you institutionalize a music industry in a city. Mm. I mean, so it's nuts and bolts kinds of things, and I've enjoyed having the mayor in my city and discussing these kinds of issues. It's more strategic, I think, than lofty.
Go ahead.
Well, look, nobody's asking anybody to leave their core values at the door. You can walk into the mayor's office with your core values. You can be a fiscal conservative. You can be socially in tune with different things. Whatever it is that you bring as your core values, you can do that as a mayor. But at the end of the day, you have to pull a staff together. If you came to my office, you'd see a very diverse staff. You'd see a diversity of thought. And that's a luxury you have in the mayor's office that I'm not sure you have in some other places.
You're both white males. When you become mayor, how does your sensitivity to racial issues become a skill set that you have to either develop or express better? What can you do and what have you done to address issues that are really challenging in places like Ferguson, for instance?
Well, you know, it probably depends on the person who's coming into the mayor's office. I'm an attorney. I started out as a civil rights attorney. So it was something that I had been involved in through the years on the National Advisory Board of the Anti-Defamation League. So I came into the office already with a certain sensitivity, but it's pulling together the folks in the community. The times are changing, and I think that there is a greater understanding of how racial inequities are impacting the overall economic well-being of cities. The loss of potential associated with historic patterns is something now.
How has
that
track record in Austin been frustrating for you to make progress?
Well, you know, it's frustrating because it exists, but it's exciting because I think the critical mass is there to change that. And part of the Living Cities initiative here is just another attempt and another way to localize and focus the critical mass to deal with the issues of racial.
And for me, you sit and listen. You listen. You let your community coach you as a mayor. You sit down and say, listen, not everybody's walked a mile in the same shoes. And that means among different groups in your community. So just stop and listen, build policy around those discussions, and every time we've done that, we've had great success.
One techie question before we go.
Sure.
Is the establishment of Wi-Fi in cities in America an opportunity to revisit racial equity questions? And basically, Wi-Fi for everyone suddenly involves a lot of social issues as well?
Absolutely. There's a digital divide, I think, in many communities, certainly in Austin. So we're trying to combat that. We're taking that kind of digital access to parts of the community that didn't otherwise have it. So much of living in today's society requires that connectivity. When it doesn't exist, it's a real detriment.
Last 10 seconds, Mayor Barry.
Yeah, equity means lots of things, and access to information is one of those. And the more informed we are, the more we can come together, the more we're going to be able to craft solutions at work.
Well, welcome to the city of New York, Mayor Richard Barry of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Austin, Texas, Mayor Steve Adler. Have a great time here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. At the top of the political food chain, the president and vice president are actually celebrating state and local officials taking some matters into their own hands. This week, Vice President Biden was handing out congratulations for success in dealing with gun violence.
Because of the nature of the dysfunction in Congress today, you are more important in terms of national policy, than you have been in the last 50 years. We haven't been able to get it done nationally. But because we beat the drum so much and raised the awareness of the issue, you've gotten it done.
While Congress has thwarted efforts to pass universal background checks, reinstate an assault weapons ban, and to allow the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to conduct public health research into the impact of guns on society, states and localities have been moving forward. In fact, many of them have been meeting at the White House talking about their progress. Governor Daniel Malloy of Connecticut, how have you fared in your communities from Bridgeport to Fairfield?
We're making progress in Connecticut and have over the last few years, but actually over an extended period of time. We are lowering crime at a rate that is substantially greater than the national average, but particularly with respect to violent crime. And we're doing that with smart policies that are designed to get guns off the street and keep guns out of the hands of those who would use them for illegal purposes. But also, I think, good local strategies in places like New Haven and Bridgeport and Hartford that are evolving to use new technologies to make people safer.
Is there anything you've managed to do or anything on your plate or on your agenda that might have prevented the situation in Sandy Hook?
Well, you know, you hope that people learn from mistakes of the past. We certainly have changed our laws, but, you know, that a mother would, you know, make guns available to an obviously disturbed person in the family, I don't know how we prevent that except to make those practices illegal, to hold people responsible for keeping guns in locked conditions. And certainly hoping to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, including individuals who have a serious mental defect. And obviously, Mr. Lanza fell into that category.
Would you say that the people in a place like Bridgeport or New Haven are dealing with gun violence fundamentally differently than the small communities like Sandy Hook?
Sure,
and Fairfield?
I think that is absolutely the case. We know that disproportionately with respect to violent crime, it does tend to occur in urban environments, and that's why bringing projects like Project Longevity to our biggest cities, where we go after the folks that we can identify are most likely to participate in violent crime, including shootings, establish a contact with those individuals, bring them in from time to time to have conversations, help them with social services so that perhaps they get out of the rut that they're in. I mean, all of those things I think are important. And I think if we're going to spend money on keeping people safe, and we're certainly going to do that, then let's spend that money as wisely as possible. There are other things that we could also do. I mean, safe gun technology would be a big improvement, both in urban and non-urban areas. In a nation where guns have become ubiquitous, things are happening that technology could prevent from happening, and we should be deploying that. And that's one of the things that we talked about at the White House yesterday.
Are you and other governors working around Congress, or are you waiting for a partnership of some kind?
I think that we're working around Congress. I mean, Congress has not passed serious gun legislation since 1994. And the great legislation that they passed, they allowed to expire, the Brady Bill, in 2004. Now, I don't think anyone's holding their breath for Congress to act, although the American people would like them to. I mean, I think if you talk to the American people, they believe we already have universal background checks. And when you point out that we don't, they argue overwhelmingly 85, 90% of Americans think we should have universal background checks. After all, you can't get on an airplane in America without someone doing a background check on you.
Governor Daniel Malloy of Connecticut, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Political activists have taken some of these matters into their own hands. Ray Winans is a former Detroit gang member who was convicted of manslaughter when he was 15 years old and was in and out of the prison system for years before turning his life around. Now he hits the streets as a peacemaker and is helping reduce gun violence one gang member at a time. He says the top-down approach won't work without street-level programs, and he and his wife co-founded a program called Keeping Them Alive. Ray Winans, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me at The Takeaway.
What can you, as a community activist, do that police can't to achieve some of the goals that you're trying to do?
I can most definitely identify known perpetrators of violence and have conversations with them, sit down and help them navigate and create options for them outside of violence that the police don't have the capacity nor the credibility to do.
So your credibility from being a gang member and a prison convict is only part of the story. I mean, your authority comes from within you.
Yes.
So tell me how that works. Is that a magic word?
My power in the beginning, I had a false sense of power, and the power that I was using was to destroy my community. And so it was my belief in the deal that I made with God, because I was faced with a crime that I did not commit, and it was actually a murder. And I didn't believe in a power greater than myself. And at that moment, I was like, God, if you really help me out in this situation, I won't hurt people no more. I encourage people to do the right thing. I believe in Jesus. And I get a job and keep a job and help young people. 2 weeks later, the person that committed the murder stepped up to the plate. And so I kept my commitment to the power that's greater than myself, which is Christ. And so, again, that may not work for everybody. But in my situation, looking at my background, it worked for me. And so through that piece, I'm able to be an example of hope to these young people out here. And so, you know, I don't know if you read any articles, but it's law enforcement officers saying, we're reducing crime in the city of Detroit, and a lot of it is because of Ray Winans. The mayor did his State of the City address. I was heading up Ceasefire Detroit on the east side, which is 9-5. And it was an initiative that take law enforcement community members, clergy, and also returning citizens. We was able to reduce homicides by 44% on the east side of Detroit and non-fatals by 33%. And then I resigned. Now I'm in Sinai Grace Hospital doing trauma intervention, and I'm able to touch guys that even the doctors can't touch, right? And so with that being said, John, it's not necessarily everybody has to be a convicted felon, but you have to be relevant. You have to be relevant.
How is understanding that your community is important the same or similar to recognizing a bigger power than yourself?
It comes down to love. I knew a bunch of killers. That was the lifestyle that I lived. That was the neighborhoods in which I grew up in. And I said, but everybody would accept prayer. Everybody had somebody that they loved. We may be able to get 6 out of 10, but there's 6 that we ordinarily wouldn't have. Whatever you serve, it can be a cell phone. It's something, and everybody know that they have a personal responsibility.
How do people embrace activism as something that is a real calling?
One, I think that by identifying the issue that they totally against, and so when somebody has something that they're against, they have something that they stand up for, right? So for me, it's violence, because I committed juvenile violence. My redemption came when baby Derek Dwayne Miller, 9-month-old baby on the west side of Detroit, was murdered. I quit my job, started doing volunteer work because I was totally against that. I meet people all the time, animal rights activists. It's always something.
Do the cops understand that, or do they need to understand that? Or do they just view you as like, oh, he just understands the people in the neighborhood. I don't have to understand them.
So actually, it's some that get it and it's some that don't. However, we need cops that don't understand. Again, if we all understood, then what kind of world would we be living in, right?
What have you learned about the power of people at the local level taking matters into their own hands to make social change?
That they don't really understand the power that they have to collaborate. I've yet to see individuals come together in a true collaboration, and that's why we faced with the issues, because you have two concepts that we normally hear. You got thinking in a box, thinking outside the box. Myself, I use the concept, man, step outside the box, destroy the box, and just think.
Ray Winans, former Detroit gang member and a founder with his wife of Keeping Them Alive, an anti-violence program in the city of Detroit. Thanks so much, Ray.
Thank you for having me.
So let's bounce back to the top of the food chain, politically speaking, and after all the talk this hour of moving forward, pragmatic change at the local level, the 2016 presidential campaign seems to be caught in a time warp, and they're not visiting the future. Donald Trump certainly isn't in talking about the Clinton years.
In the history of politics, Hillary Clinton's husband abused women more than any man that we know of, and Hillary was an enabler. And she treated these women horribly. Just remember this.
Trump economics is a recipe for lower wages, fewer jobs, more debt. He could bankrupt America like he's bankrupted his companies.
Hillary Clinton talking about Donald Trump's past at a rally in Detroit on Monday. Donald Trump earlier this month at a rally in Spokane, Washington. And this Trump rally from last night in Albuquerque sounded like a flashback to the 1968 Chicago convention. Hillary will have a difficult time escaping the past and getting back to the issues she claims she wants to talk about. The State Department Inspector General concluded this week that while she was Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton violated federal record-keeping guidelines by having her own private email server. Are the present old rehashings of scandals going to continue right up until November? Have the high-minded ideals of the Obama years given way to pure partisanship and political combat, or is this just how the American democratic system works? Sean Wilentz is author of The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. Sean, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be here, John.
So was Obama high-minded, and is this 2016 election a partisan mudsling?
Well, not all partisan politics are mudslinging, but this very much is. I mean, you know, President Obama's a partisan politician, a party politician. He ran as a politician. He's a very good one. This year it's different. This year the hyper-partisanship of the Republican Party has helped produce Donald Trump, and we're in for the nastiest campaign certainly in our lifetimes.
And Bernie versus Hillary? There's an ideological component within the party there, and yeah. Hillary's trying to suppress it with procedural.
Well, I mean there's a division not so much within the Democratic Party. Bernie brought people from outside the Democratic Party who hadn't been there before and has run as a Democrat. So the Democrats are in the middle of this fight, yeah. That in many ways goes back a very long time, that fight inside the Democratic Party between what do you want to call them, the new politics types mm-hmm. and the new Democrats. So this is erupting again. But it's erupting in the post-2008 environment. And that's very important to understand. I mean I don't think that the country is taking proper account of how devastating that was and how much it's affected our politics.
The economy.
The crash.
Right.
So what the crash has meant is that you get Trump coming along, right, who's not talking about trade deals, talking a lot like Bernie Sanders, addressing Republicans who felt sold out by the party because the party had nothing to offer them in the aftermath of what happened in 2008. Same thing's kind of happening in the Democratic Party.
You argue in this book that egalitarianism and ideas of real social justice and social progress come when establishment politicians are ultimate persuaders within the system, like Johnson was in convincing his Democratic colleagues to go along with the Civil Rights Act,
right.
And that's how it works.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work the way Barack Obama attempted to bring people along as a part of a movement.
I mean, certainly President Obama did a lot, so it's not to say that he didn't do anything, but I think that's right. I think the post-partisan idea that he came to office with, as he himself learned, can only get you so far. It's not going to be a way to get things done when you have to resort to doing things like grand bargains, when you start trying to work things out with a Republican Party that doesn't want you to be there and will do everything it can to undermine you. But you're right, I think, about Johnson and others. FDR is another example. Going all the way back, Thomas Jefferson is something of an example of this too. Change happens in the United States when the forces of egalitarianism, which are always there, the egalitarian tradition goes back to the beginning, manage to converge with those elements inside the political system who are not just willing to be to listen, but in fact also have the same kinds of ideas. Much of the time, the two are out of joint. They're not working together. When they do manage to come together, when you have very skillful reformers like Martin Luther King Jr., who's really a revolutionary in many ways, and a very skilled politician working together, then things get done.
So campaigners are not deal makers necessarily.
Campaigners meaning?
Good campaigners. People who run great presidential campaigns don't necessarily have the capacity
absolutely not
to make deals.
No, no, no. And look, there is a political system. There is politics in America. You know, we often don't want to talk about the fact that there is politics. But there's politics. There's the politics of running for office, and there's the politics of governing. And inside the system that we've got, you have to be able to be a good party politician in working within the system.
So who's the better deal maker here, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton?
Oh, I mean, in terms of the government, there's no question. I mean, what goes on in Washington, D.C., the kinds of things that you need to get done, and what goes on in abroad in terms of making international accords bear no resemblance whatsoever to what Donald Trump has been doing all of his life. I mean, it's not just about deals. Deals don't occur in the abstract. Deals occur within a context. And you have to understand how Capitol Hill works. You have to understand how you're going to get things done, how Lyndon Johnson brilliantly managed to leverage and use his understanding of how the system works. That's just a different – not just a different ballgame. We're talking about a different universe.
Do we have evidence that Hillary can do that, though, bring people around on the other side? I mean, she's a very divisive figure. And
yeah, I think if you go back to her Senate career, Republicans themselves say that they respect her a great deal. Parts of the government that you would think that wouldn't be, you know, very happy with her, the military among others, they see her as a person who they can deal with. And that's happened. And she certainly has much more experience with all of that. Not that she's gotten everything she wants done, but she's – look, she's the most experienced candidate we've had coming into to a campaign in a very, very long time. She knows how that works. People use that against her, saying that everybody in Washington is corrupt and therefore we have to get rid of them all. But I mean, I think that's just demagogy. I mean, it's not actually understanding what – how the system works and how we're going to get it done.
Times reviewed your book and said you're a historian with a Clinton agenda.
Did they say Clinton? I can't remember that one. Well, I don't know if that was a review, John, as much as
yeah, that was
personal,
tough.
It was a personal attack more than it was
that
a
was
review.
Tough. Yeah. That was tough.
Yeah.
Politics there or?
You'll have to ask
the
reviewer.
Ask them, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, right. Absolutely. Right. Well, Sean Wilentz is the author of The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. Boy, we will certainly see how some of the ideas in this book play out in 2016. Sean Wilentz, thanks so much.
Great, John. Good to see you.
Here's something to take with you today, a fairly random message from country music legend Charlie Daniels.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up.
The singer of The Devil Went Down to Georgia decided he needed to introduce the Ayatollahs of Iran to his version of the United States, and here goes.
You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends. But you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland.
It's an NRA-sponsored spot. Speaking of partisanship, Daniels implied that perhaps Iran should be scared of, well, here's the real America.
You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water.
Gator wrestling swamp people. Daniels last had a charted song in 1982.
You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do.
And Charlie, First Amendment is a beautiful thing. We love free speech in America. And if you'd like to talk about Charlie Daniels and partisanship in America, 8778 is our number. That's all for today. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International. I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.